Hello, welcome, and good day. Crack open a can of Foster's, put a shrimp on the barbie, and come join us at the Bitter End Podcast for a very special, inexplicably Australian episode today. My name is Tom Denny.
My name is Todd Jordan.
And we're here to watch The Howling 3, The Marsupials.
Do you come from the land down under? If you do, I'm very, very sorry.
Yeah, it's going to be, I mean, we'll try not to be too... bust out too many terrible Australian stereotypes, but I feel that The Howling 3, The Marsupials, the Australian edition into the Howling franchise, is going to do far worse than we will.
Tom, can I ask you a question? Why, oh why, do you think that they decided to follow up The Howling 2 with a film set entirely in Australia?
I mean, The Howling 2... has a lot of it goes on in Transylvania, and that didn't really make very much sense to me because vampires come from Australia, come from Transylvania.
I have two very key facts for you here that might enlighten us. Mm. Fact number one, this film is directed by Philippe Mora, who also directed The Howling 2. Mm. He is an Australian gentleman.
Is he?
He is an Australian gentleman.
It's not a very Australian-sounding name.
French-born Australian citizenship.
Fair enough.
Do you, maybe they, he didn't get that citizenship until after he directed this, and they were like, oh, bloody bonzer, mate. Yeah, you deserve a passport for that.
Yeah, because it's really hard to get citizenship in Australia. So if you actually get, like, you know, you go to the tourist board of Australia and they're like, oh, can I make this film? It's going to be really big. Maybe you've heard of Joe Dante's The Howling.
And like, oh, yeah, I love Joe Dante's The Howling, mate. Oh, yeah, ripper.
You haven't heard of The Howling 2, have you? Never heard of it, mate. Good, good, okay. And what's the other fact?
Well, the fact number two is that this film was made in 1987, 2 years after The Howling 2, 1 year after Crocodile Dundee.
I was thinking Crocodile Dundee would be a big factor, because Crocodile Dundee was fucking massive. Like it was a big film, but also just in terms of budget to actual, like, box office gross, it was a fucking big bucks movie.
Yeah, big deal.
Yeah, I mean, this film, I mean, was definitely spoofed in an episode of The Simpsons.
Which episode was that?
The episode where Principal Skinner starts dating Patty, Marge's sister, and he goes and takes her on a date to go and see Space Mutants 4, and that one is set in Australia, and you've got, like, a boy and a girl in the back of a car, and, like, the girl's like, oh, I can't believe what happened to that dingo back there. And he's like, oh, it was probably just a wallaby. And then a space mutant pops out with like a pouch with a little baby space mutant in it, like a kangaroo.
Oh.
So that's 100% influenced by this film, and that may be the only enduring influence that this film has had on pop culture. So we watched the trailer.
We watched the trailer for The Marsupials, Howling 3. I've got to say, it didn't go quite as hard on the Australia shit as I thought it would. It saved a lot of that till the very last minute.
The moment when it does go hard on the Australian shit, it goes at it like...
Yeah.
Like, only... like. Well, it's funny that the director is actually from Australia, because... it's done right by, like, it appears like it's been made by someone who's never been to Australia ever. So, like, the film just looks like a fucking, it looks really budget, even more budget than the last one.
It's crossed into the realms of parody, I think. You know, the Howling 2 was, as much as I had a lot of fun watching it, but it was a low quality horror film. This now has gone so far that it looks like a parody of low-quality horror films. It looks like someone's doing it on purpose.
It looks like it was done on someone's camcorder. It looks like the werewolves are made out of sock puppets.
Yeah.
And then halfway through, some guy pops up and goes, "G'day, mate, you want to put a shrimp on the barbie?" And it's like, I've never been to Australia. That's what I would have done if I was making the film. The dude who directed this is actually from Australia. So either he's, like, dumbing down Australian culture, or he's just kind of like, yeah, we are just like that, really.
Yeah, true that. There was a lot of interesting stuff in the trailer. There was what looked like a ballet recital where all of the dancers, one by one, do little pirouettes and turn into wolves. Now, I was expecting were-roos, kangaroo werewolves.
Now, where I can see this happening is, it looks like there's a bit of, like, a woman in bed with her boyfriend, husband, whoever, and it looks like she's got, like, some baby wolf coming out of her stomach, maybe in a marsupial fashion, that there is the kind of the pouch. So that's the only kind of like kangaroo-y, marsupial-y kind of thing that I really saw in there. There seems to be a lot of stuff. We seem to be following like a scientist with a big, thick moustache who is saying that they've like discovered scientific proof of werewolves and has some sort of like machine that induces werewolf transformation in somebody by flashing a torch in somebody's face.
Yeah.
So there seems to be that. And
still
then
more of the sort of werewolf hunter shtick. They've seemed to have dropped a lot of the like vampire trappings that Christopher Lee gave us last time, for better or worse.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, my only like my big takeaway from this is that it just looks like a fucking hot mess.
Yeah.
It really does. I mean, quite startlingly so compared to what was going on in the last film. I mean, at least like The Howling 2, the trailer looked like garbage, but it looked like a fairly well-constructed shitty trailer. This just looked like, again, it looked like a fan film.
For what it's worth, I feel like I need to tell our listeners that this is the first time since doing this podcast we've ever gotten to the end of a trailer and Tom has immediately said, oh, let's watch that again.
Yeah, yeah. Like, because I just couldn't. There was a lot to take in. You should look it up because it's it's a dilly of a pickle. There's a lot going on in there.
It will sprain your neck. It will whip you around so fast.
Yeah.
Well, before we dive in to the marsupials, the hot mess, Tom, would you like to play the IMDb guessing
yeah,
game?
Yeah, okay.
So just for a recap, The Howling 2, Your Sister is a Werewolf. That was a 3.3, which is possibly a career low for The Bitter End. What are your feelings about the marsupials?
I don't know. I didn't really think anything could get worse than Howling 2, but this looks just inexplicably bad. I think it's going to go below 3. 2.8.
Well, good news, buddy. Yeah. It does not go below a 3.
Woo!
But it does go down from where we last were. It's a 3.1.
Whoa.
Clinging on for dear life.
Oh my God. Never, like, this is such a steep fall from grace with this franchise. It is crazy. But I really enjoyed watching Howling 2.
And I think we're going to have a lot of fun for the next 86 minutes or however long.
Yeah, yeah. I really hope so, because it looks like a right rip snorting time. So, should we go
put a shrimp on the Barbie, Tom?
Mate, I'm going to put on my beer hat, strap two cans of Foster's into it, and just go ham on this film.
Bonza. Australia. That's Australia, folks.
Yes, Howling 3, brought to you by the Tourist Board of Australia. Fuck me, dude. Was it a ripper of a good time for you?
I loved it. I really loved it. It could have been 20 minutes tighter.
Oh, definitely. I feel like I've been on a long-haul flight. I mean, the film is only like an hour and 40 minutes, which isn't that long, but it feels long. And like, the end of it really peters out quite bad, you know.
Then it comes back in the most insane way.
Oh, it's a fucking weird. How did this guy get to direct another film?
I just feel like maybe he made the last one, which is set partly in LA, partly in Transylvania. Couldn't work in that town again. Went home, just made another one. Didn't tell anyone about it.
Yeah,
just made it with his mates.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it does have it does smack of, you know, filmed on the weekends with your camcorder. But let's break it down.
I mean, there's a lot that I like about it. There's the ending is like properly ripped from a nightmare. We'll get to that later, but it's like a childhood's, like one of those traumatic childhood nightmares that stays with you.
Yeah.
It's super powerful. It's got the bits that they change about the lore, I like. There's a few little tiny nods to the original, subtle, but they're there. I like those. It's got a lot of cast members that are from the Mad Max films.
Yeah, I like that.
I love that.
It's, yeah, like, there are some interesting ideas in there. It is executed in quite a strange fashion. I think that is the thing. Like, there is something in there, but like they've kind of like fit too much into the beginning and then let the end of the film just go walkabout for about 20 minutes. So let's start at the beginning.
Yeah, let's start at the beginning.
So
no boomerangs.
No boomerangs.
I wanted it to be boomerangs left, right, and center.
What you get, spooky didgeridoo music at the beginning. Dun, 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 dun. As you get...
Sorry, Tom, I'm doing my didgeridoo.
You carry on. You carry on.
Sorry, okay, you can talk.
So we have this shot of like an Aboriginal tribe who have what looks to be a werewolf strung up to a tree that's dead, and they just smile at the camera really creepily for quite a long time.
Now, straight away, this opening shot kind of had me. I was into it because it's shot in like... in the style of what would be a more modern found footage horror movie.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like sort of ropey. I think the credit on the screen says something like 1905 Australia. And you know, so it's like old film strip style. These Aboriginal guys, they admittedly, the wolf monster that they've got tied to the tree looks ropey. It has human legs because I just think they couldn't be bothered.
Yeah.
But it's kind of interesting. They're like, look what we've killed. We've got it tied to a tree. They look really proud of themselves. And then you're thinking about like, well, who is filming this? Like, what is going on?
And then it cuts to Siberia. Similar time and of like what looks like a dead wolf person in the snow and somebody like running and screaming towards the camera. And then we cut to America to like, I think it's like the CIA or the FBI, and they are monitoring the KGB, and someone picks up like a transmission from the KGB saying something about werewolf bodies discovered in Siberia or something like that. It's like, do you think we should tell the president about this? And then we cut to, fucking lightning cuts. We cut to one of our main characters whose name is Vecmeyer. Now, he is basically an Australian John Cleese impersonator. That is what he looks like. He is some kind of scientist.
Yeah, I think he's like an anthropologist. Yeah. He's talking at a university in America. And he's explaining that his granddad is the guy that shot that footage in Australia. Shot that footage and then disappeared in the outback. And he says to his students, what's interesting about this footage is how much more realistic the tribal mask on the wolf totem is than the rest of the tribe's masks. So he doesn't think it's a real wolf. Then his students are like, what are you doing at the weekend, mate? And he's like, oh, I've got to go to Washington. Cut!
He goes to see the president. He goes and has a meeting with the president of the United States, who is wearing a white bathrobe, who's just hanging out by the pool.
There's no like explanation. There's no shot of the White House or anything. He goes, oh, I'm going to Washington. Instant cut. He's in a room talking to this old man in a bathrobe. They chat for a good couple of minutes until he eventually goes, ah, well, I did have a question for you, Mr. President.
Yeah. And also, like, he goes, Mr. President, what's this? And then they look directly at the camera and go, and the president goes, oh, yeah, we're just filming everything from now on. So you're like, what, is this a documentary-style film? No, it's literally just this scene that is filmed like it's a documentary. And he basically goes and talks to the president about, we think there are werewolves, and we think that they are in Russia, and we think they're in Australia. And the president just kind of...
He says, why Australia? And Venkmeyer goes, there are all sorts of natural freaks down there.
Yeah.
Look at the platypus. That's what he says. And the president...
Look at Paul Hogan.
The president is like, yeah, sound logic. Off you go. And then cut, and then we're suddenly in Australia.
Yeah, it suddenly cuts. Boom, Sydney Opera House. And you're just like, oh, fuck, I think I've got whiplash. Yeah. My like neck just going like, wah, 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 wah.
Jet lag like, from the first 5 minutes of this movie.
Yeah, Vecmeyer is talking to his mate Sharp, who is like another, like a scientist colleague out in Australia. And they're like, well, let's go and investigate werewolves, shall we? Okay, cut. Again, suddenly, we're in something that looks very Mad Max-esque. We've got Jaboa, who...
Okay, so we need to talk about Jaboa because she is our heroine. I want to give her a proper intro.
Yeah.
Jaboa's fucking great, man. I love Jaboa. She is a, what you want to say, like 21-year-old?
Yeah, she's a young horror movie heroine, isn't she?
Yeah, and she's in the outback of Australia, and she's we're introduced to her very quickly, and it becomes apparent that she is growing up in part of a werewolf tribe.
I mean, nothing, they don't really give away anything that is to say they're a werewolf tribe, apart from the fact it's a howling film.
Yeah.
And everybody is based... You've got, like, one main guy and loads of women. So, like, it's like a wolf pack kind of scenario. And they're living just, like... They're living in a feral lifestyle. The pack leader, who he's an actor, the character's called Thilo, and this guy has been in Mad Max 1 and 2. Not in, like, prominent sort of roles, but, like, if you look, when you see him, you just be like, oh, yeah, that guy's got Mad Max written all over his face. So, basically, she seems to be being, like, held. She doesn't want to be in this wolf commune. And she gets dragged off by a bunch of wolf women to go and see Thilo, the head of the pack. And she's like, no, I don't want to see him. He hurt me last time. And she gets dragged over to him and he grabs her and really like leers at her and is very sexual. And he says to her,
I'll buy you a Sony Walkman if you behave yourself. A Sony one, you say, not off brand?
Yeah. Then, cut, she's on a bus escaping with a priest who cannot act.
Don't be afraid of me, my child. I want to help you.
I don't need any help.
You should not run away from home.
I don't like home.
Why, child?
Because my stepfather tried to rape me and he's a werewolf.
Boom, cut. She's sleeping on a park bench where suddenly these two drunk Aussies, like one of them who's got like sunglasses with only one lens in it, they come up and like they're like all pissed. Oh, come on, love. Do you want to have some fun? Oh, I'll give you Mysterio. And then she suddenly starts, she gets like the wolf contact lenses and the pointy teeth and looks right at him and just shouts, compact disc. And it's like, what is with all the fucking like music formats going on?
That is the main currency in Australia in 1987, Tom.
I know. So she goes, compact disc. They run off. Boom. Cut. She's sat by the Sydney Opera House again in the middle of the day on a bench, just looking out to sea. Some dude in a sports car pulls up, sees her, like gets out of the car and just charges towards her. She's like, I don't like the look of this. Fucking legs it. Runs for about like a minute and a half. Like all these stairs is chasing. And then she's like, oh, what do you want? What do you want? He's like, I want you to be in a film.
Tom, I think you need to take a breath, mate.
This film needs to take a fucking breath. Like, this is the bit when like I was just kind of like, hang on, wait, what? 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 And you were just like, just keep up. Just keep up. I was like, I can't keep up. So like, yeah. So basically she gets chased by this guy, Donnie, who he's a scout working on a horror film. What's the horror film called?
Oh, mate, I will tell you what Donnie's horror film is called. Donnie's horror film is called Shapeshifters, Part 8.
Yes.
Which I think is a nice little dig at the kind of the concept of the horror sequel. Little did they know that The Howling would turn into an 8-part franchise.
I know. Very prophetic. Yeah, and he's like, you look perfect for this horror film. And she's like, what's a horror film? I don't know. And he's like, no, come on, you're going to be great. It's not great money, but you're perfect for the part. Come with me. And off she goes to be on a horror film.
A werewolf film, no less.
A werewolf film, yeah. And then we cut again back to another bus.
The same bus.
The same bus, which has got three nuns on it. Now, these nuns are having a conversation. One of them is saying like, oh, yeah, she can smell a wallaby 10 miles away. She was on this bus. So, like, basically, we get that. I think these are nuns from the wolf commune, and they are hunting Jaboa to take her back. Mm. See, like, this is one of the things with this film, that there are scenes that are just missing, that you just needed to establish stuff a little bit. Like, the fact that, like, Jaboa's escape is just indicated by the fact she's just on a bus with this priest. Like, you don't see, it's implied that obviously that Thilo is having his wicked way with her and that she doesn't want to do that and she wants to leave, but you never see it.
You don't see her escape.
Yeah.
You don't see her do a runner. She's just there and then she's not.
You don't see, and you don't see, like, the consequences of, like, her, you know, she just goes, like, no, I don't like him. You don't really get, like... Yeah, like, there's just, like, seems like there was, like, some scenes missing, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that this is the thing, like, with a lot of bits of this film where you suddenly go, oh, I guess we're just here now.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
They're just like, keep up, audience, fill in the gaps.
This movie is the cinematic equivalent of playing peekaboo, with a baby, but you're the baby. It's just like, oh, what's this now? Oh, okay, I guess, ooh, that's a surprise. Oh, what's going on? I'm in the dark. Oh, I guess that we're doing this now. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. So now Jaboa is on this film. She's on the set of Shapeshifters 8, and we get introduced to the director.
The director is a character called Jack Citron. Now, he is played by an actor also in one of the Mad Max movies.
Frank Thring. He is in Mad Max 3, Thunderdome.
Who does he play in Mad Max 3?
He plays the Collector, who... he's a big bloke. He's a big lad, bald, bit of a lovey, quite actorious.
Yeah, he wears a black shirt and he's got a crow's skull on a rope around his neck.
Yeah, so in Mad Max, he is the guy that takes away all the weapons when he enters Bartertown. In this, he is a very, like, lovey director of horror. Apparently, he's the best horror director in the game.
Yeah.
He says
things like, oh, are you aware of Andy Warhol's work? He taught us that everything is high art. That's what this is all about. This is all about everything is high art. For example, our first scene will see you gang raped by shapeshifters. How do you feel about that? At this point, me and Tom are like, mate, she is the survivor of a horrible abuse cult. She's escaped. Yeah. This isn't going to go well. And she's just like, yeah, I'll do anything to be in a film, mate.
She's actually just laughing because she sees the werewolf and he goes, they don't really look like that.
Yeah.
She's not like, so for your first scene, you will be gang raped by four people. And she's not just kind of like, oh my God, I've just escaped one horror to go and relive it on a film set. No. She's just kind of like, oh, that sounds funny. Funny story. Like, oh, it's... This is a bit of like...
It's around this point that we get a bit of character development around Jaboa. So she tells... Donnie the Scout, he's kind of trying to put the moves on her in a nice-ish way. He's like slightly creeping on her, but he's not a baddie.
It is creepy that he's basically essentially picked up a homeless woman that he's tried to crack onto.
Yeah.
He's like, hey, homeless girl, come and be in this film and then I will try and have sex with you. Which is basically what their relationship is.
So she's then in this film and she plays this part where she's got a dress on and like quite glamorous hair, and a man in a werewolf costume keeps coming up behind her and she keeps having to scream, and there's this quite funny scene of them just repeatedly shooting her screaming over and over again. She's chatting to Donnie, transpires she's never seen a film.
And not even, she's never seen a horror film?
No, she says she's never seen a film.
Okay, yeah.
Because she tells Donnie that she is from a town called Flow. F-L-O-W. What does that spell? If you read it backwards. Oh, mate, nice touch. Oh, God damn. Boom. She's from Flow. Very small town. Never seen a film before. So Donnie's like, tell you what, Sheila, tonight we're going to go out. I'm going to take you to see a horror film. He takes her to see a film called It Came From Uranus. It's another werewolf film, during which she nudges Donnie during the werewolf transformation and goes, that's not how it happens.
And the werewolf transformation in this is like the first transformation that we see in the film. And it's weird because you can't tell if at this point, because the whole thing of It Came From Uranus is it's satirizing horror. So you can't tell if the werewolf transformation is purposefully trying to look shit or this is as good as we're going to get in this film. And part of this transformation is as good as you get in the film. And then it just goes a little bit further at the end and basically turns the werewolf into... It reminds me of, like, you know, like a Punch and Judy show where you've got, like, the crocodile. It, like, had that, like... That, like, wooden, clacky,
yeah,
kind
snappy.
Of, like... Yeah, yeah, that kind of mouth. It was... It goes... completely ridiculous at the end, but the bulk of that transformation is about as good as like the wolf effects get in the film. And then we cut to them at Donnie's place and they've just fucked.
Now they have it's quick, passionate romance.
They've known each other for like a day and a half, it would seem, and they have just like boned down heartily because they've been hosed down in sweat. Donnie, in basically every other scene in this film, Donnie is dripping in sweat.
Globules of Vaseline, like in spherical shapes on his face, completely motionless.
He's like a slime monster, I think.
Yeah. Now, we are going to have to... I don't know if we can talk this whole thing through scene by scene for speed, but I do want to talk about this scene that happened in bed with them immediately after they've boned down. So, it's so hot, right? So, she's taken the sheets off the bed. She's still asleep. She is in a bra, and she's lying on her back. And Donnie is awake, and he is looking over at his new girlfriend, and he notices something slightly strange about her body. She has got a downy fluff all up and down her tummy. She's got a furry stomach.
Mm.
And if he looks a bit closer, what's that? And the music's going dun, 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 dun. She's got a fucking kangaroo pouch.
Yes.
Oh, no.
She's a marsupial.
Your sister is a marsupial. And then it just cuts.
And then it cuts. And then there's a bit more like faffing around with what's his name? Venkmeyer and what's like his mate. Yeah, they're just prattling on a bit. We're introduced to a whole thing. There's a Russian ballerina.
Olga,
who is in Australia, and you go, oh, Russia, well, they, for some reason, they're like, let's go and talk to this Russian ballerina because she's the only Russian in Australia. She might know about werewolves. Just so happens that Olga, like, during a rehearsal that they're watching, transforms into a werewolf.
Oh, shit!
And she just seems to transform for no reason. Like, she seems worried. She's talking to her her assistant, who's also a werewolf, and, like, she seems to be worried that she's about to turn. So this seems to contradict some of the rules that have been set up in The Howling, so we should probably have a little dip into Rules Corner.
Rules Corner.
Ow. Right, so The Howling world, werewolves don't change because of the full moon. They can change at will. Now, in this film, it seems like they can't quite control... that there are times when they can't control it, and it seems to happen in this scene. She's just in the middle of dancing, she just feels it coming on, and she turns into a wolf in the middle of the rehearsal. One of the other dancers jumps into her, and she bites his fucking head off. Now, like, there's a bit where they're talking to Thilo, like, the head of the wolf pack, and he says that they can transform because of...
When they get scared.
When they get scared or they get into fights. So I don't know why...
He also says flashing lights. I wonder if the dancing scene may have seen... But if she's a ballerina anyway, she should be
there's
used
no
to that.
Flashing lights now. I mean, it's ballet. It's not a rave.
Yeah.
And there's bits with Jaboa where she kind of feels like she's got to change, but there doesn't seem to be any reason for it other than the plot demands it.
Yeah.
So there's a little addition there to the rules. We'll probably pop back to Rules Corner in a little bit, because there's some other rules.
Well, before we leave it, I just wonder your opinion on this, guys. So spoiler alert, guys, beyond the fact that Jaboa has like a little pouch on her tummy, and a couple of other tiny plot points later, we never get kangaroo people.
No, we don't.
I was hoping that, you know, the marsupials Howling 3 would be about kangaroo people. We don't get that. The Australian werewolves are slightly different from the American werewolves in that they've got their own mythology, which we can deal with, but physically, they're not that different.
No. When it kind of gets revealed what their ancestry is, I think you then can see it a little bit, but they do just look a little bit like doff wolves.
This is probably a good time to just skip ahead slightly and explain what their ancestry is, because I've got that on the same page of notes.
Right, okay. So there's a bit where Thilo explains where these Australian werewolves came from. And it comes from the Tasmanian wolf.
Also called a thylacine.
Yeah, so these are like big fucking weird looking nasty wolves, and they had the pouches and all that.
If you're on a computer right now, if you've got your phone nearby that you're listening to this podcast on, Google thylacine or Tasmanian wolf. Do an image search. It will show you what they look like. They're fucking weird, man.
Yeah, and it's a little bit what the wolves look like. But basically, they were hunted down, supposedly, by British colonists because they were believed to be evil creatures. And they were all killed off. And then when they were killed off, the spirit of the Tasmanian wolf went into people and created the Aussie Wolfman. So it's a bit more of an explanation for why we have werewolves than we have in previous films.
Yeah. And later on in the film, towards the climax, when there's some particularly dramatic moments, some of the Australian werewolves summon the power of Amanan to basically possess them and turn them into the big wolf.
The big wolf is like, turn me into the big one, as one of them says. Yeah, so that's the law. That is the new law.
Interesting touch. I don't hate it.
Yeah, and I think like the actual like the Tasmanian wolf is a lot cooler than an option than going with the kangaroo, which is what we were assuming.
Yeah,
because Australia.
Australia. We do get that pouch bit, though, the marsupial pouch, and I'm into that. So long story short, Olga the Russian ballerina gets captured by John Cleese. Meanwhile, Jaboa takes shelter in a barn full of hay bales, and we witness the single grossest giving birth scene in cinema history.
Oh, man.
It is, I think, quite well done. It is just rank, mate.
It's probably the best done bit of the film. It's really, you've never seen anything like it. Basically, this little kind of like voley shrew kangaroo baby pops out of where you would expect a baby to pop out of, and then it starts to crawl up her belly,
her furry belly,
and she kind of like licks her hand and kind of like makes it all moist for the baby to crawl up, and it crawls up and gets in her pouch.
I think that is actually factually accurate to what happens to real roo babies. It's quite detailed the way they've shot it.
Yeah,
it's quite good. It's just kind of gross.
Yeah, it's a very strange scene, and this is like happening back at the wolf cult, because she's been taken back by the nun wolves.
Yeah,
and a lot happens in this film, folks.
There's a bit
say
where the nun wolves catch up with her, and then they kill all the humans basically, and then they take her back.
Oh yeah, because basically there's a rap party for the film, and then Jaboa does a runner, gets hit by a car, goes to hospital. The nuns take her, kill everybody. She goes back to the fucking like wolf enclosure, has the baby, Donnie comes, they fuck off. All in the space of 10 minutes. Fucking lightning pace, some of this film. Meanwhile, they've captured Olga as well. They hypnotize her to find out a bit of like werewolf lore through her. And her assistant, he wolfs out, comes and tries to kill him. He gets shot. Oh, God, there's a lot going on, man. I'm getting lost.
We sound a bit jumbled. Film is a bit jumbled. Okay, so I'm gonna pile drive us into the nut of this.
Please do.
Okay, so it all basically transpires that Vecmire, the professor who's trying to kind of track down these wolves, he gets proof of their existence, and then his team get an order from the president to wipe them out, just like those thylacines, those Tasmanian wolves. And he's like, nah, mate, not having it. Not doing that, because, you know, it suddenly turns into this like conservation anti-extinction message, and they're like, oh, it's a parallel human race that's been growing in secret. We have to preserve it. He falls in love with Olga, the Russian ballerina werewolf, and he sets them all free.
And the reason that Olga is in Australia is that she is there to mate with Thilo. That the two wolf packs, the Russian and the Australian wolf packs, are meant to join together. And then
she doesn't really love Thilo.
Doesn't really love Thilo. And in the end, she ends up with John Cleese.
Yeah. So then we get this cool kind of like outback chasey bit where the werewolves are basically on the run through the outback. They're trying to hide from the humans. So there's a mixture of Americans and Australian police that are trying to track them down.
Yeah,
so we get some cool moments in there. So
we should point out who it is that is on the run. So you've got Dr. John Cleese.
Yeah.
Olga the ballerina. Philo, who up until this point has been a baddie, but then John Cleese is like, no, you can't kill these this species. So he frees him because he's been captured as well. And then we've got Jaboa and Donnie. And then they're being helped out by their mate, who's like another werewolf.
Yeah, he's an Aboriginal guy. His name's Kendi. He's the guy from the trailer who pops up out of nowhere and goes, rah, want to put a shrimp on the barbie?
Yes, yes.
He's loads of fun. And he, to try and protect the on-the-run wolf pack from the humans. It's very interesting to point out that this is the first film so far in the series where the wolves are the goodies.
Yeah, the film really takes a weird turn at this point. It's interesting, but it slows down more and more and more as it unfurls. But yes, so we have Kendi. He gets possessed by the Phantom, or like the Great Wolf.
Yes,
to try and protect them.
And it's so gnarly. He does this thing where he paints his body in like white dust, and he draws red bones on his skin with all this paint, and he goes like, possess me, turn me into the big wolf. At which point we get the gnarliest fucking wolfing out, Tom, which I think backs us into a corner that I like to call Wolves Corner.
Wolves Corner! Oh, woo!
All right, guys. Let's settle into Wolves Corner, because this is some serious shit right here. Straight away, I want to tell you that the wolves in this are better than they were in The Howling 2. They're not gorilla suits.
They don't look like gorilla suits, definitely. There's not so much in the way of transformation, like animatronics, like in like you have in the first one with like things kind of elongating and puffing out and all of that. It's a lot of cut to a wolf, cut to someone reacting, cut to someone in a different wolf costume to show progression. But it is better than it's more consistent than the second one, because the second one was all over the fucking show.
Yeah, I agree with you. And they look cool. I think they do a good job of looking scary, even though they're not to be feared in this. I don't think, except for those nuns that are tracking down Jaboa.
They look like ducks.
They do look like ducks. They've got their snouts are too thin. I don't think any werewolves really kill anybody, do they? Except
They do.
Do they?
Yeah. I think there are some wolfy killings, but it is funny that you say that, because this film, it is just like the wolves are just minding their own business basically through the whole film. It's not like they're out there trying to start shit. Like, shit comes to their door, and yeah, it's they're not the baddies.
No,
even though they do some of them, they do defend themselves. Some of them, like some of them, are not nice guys. But
they're more unpleasant to each other than they are not trying to the humans.
Yeah, and they're not trying to take over the world. Like in the first and second Howling, they have designs of wiping out humanity. In this, they're just happy being fucking hobos in the woods and like shagging each other for Sony Walkmans.
So it's I feel bad for them. I mean, there's some really touching moments. Like after Kendi transforms into the Great Wolf, he manages to take out most of the humans in this Great Wolf form, and then it's too much for him, and his human body is basically lying there dying, and the rest of the wolves find him and they're like, oh, Kendi, mate, you've sacrificed so much for us. And Jaboa leans over him and says the beautiful lines, you will turn into a river, then a rainbow, then a mountain. And Kendi goes, now wait, I'm just gonna die. And then he closes his eyes and he's dead. Love it. I love Kendi.
Oh, the great bit after that, though, is that they burn his body and leave him in like a burial ground with like some other wolf human remains. And then some of the human soldiers that are tracking them, they find Kendi's like charred corpse, and he's got like a wolf skull. And the guy leans in and has a look, and then the wolf's eyes suddenly open, and then the skeleton bites the guy in the fucking neck, and then the guy like gets out a machine gun and shoots it. It's like, okay, you've got skeleton werewolf zombies just for like this like 30-second scene.
How can you not love this movie?
But that is good. And then we get Thilo being a baddie. He doesn't like Donnie because he's a human, and obviously he once possessed Jaboa.
Mm.
And he kind of like, he has it out with Donnie, and then he storms off, and he wants to become the Phantom. He gets possessed by the big wolf. He puts in all the makeup and all that. And then he goes and hunts down these soldiers. And you've got like one soldier who's by the campfire, and the one who got bit by the skeleton wolf who's lying in a tent. And he's like, mate, are you out there? Are you out there, mate? And he can't hear anything. And then like he's like, I'm feeling a bit nervous. I better get this bazooka out.
The bazooka that is basically as wide as the tent.
Yeah, he's in a tent with a... I don't know. I don't think it's a close-range weapon. well, it's definitely not, because then the great wolf sticks his head in the tent, he shoots a bazooka in its fucking face, and then you just see everything blow up.
That's basically the end of the humans.
That is the end of the humans, and that is the end of the action for a long time.
If this movie was directed by literally anyone else on Earth, this is the exact point that the credits start to roll. Philippe Mora gives you 20 more minutes, mate.
Yeah, because basically, apparently there were only two people pursuing these wolf fugitives into the outback. So then you've got, like, John Cleese, the ballerina, Jaboa and Donnie, and they're just like, well, we'll just live here forever, I guess. John Cleese has fallen in love with Olga. They have a baby.
Yeah.
They live there for 15 years.
You see both of their babies grow up, The little baby that we had that awesome birth scene with Jaboa and Donnie. The professor's baby as well.
Yeah, and she grows into, you know, like into a young adult. Jaboa and Donnie decide to leave and go back to the city. And they're like, we'll be okay. Like they're afraid of going back. They're like, no, we'll be okay. Like we'll change our identities. But John, because people will be looking for you. And then after 15 years, John Cleese's mate comes out and finds them and is just like, oh no, it's okay. The Pope's delivered an amnesty on werewolves. The Pope has decided that werewolves are all God's children.
Very progressive Pope.
And you guys can come back. The president is okay with it. Because, you know, obviously the president ordered all the werewolves in Australia to be killed. He doesn't have that authority.
But that's the point. That's the point, because the British didn't have the authority to kill the Thylacines in Australia in the first place. And that's a true story. They're making a point, Tom. It's
okay.
A very important conservationist point.
Wrapped up in a very silly film.
Yes.
So then they're like, oh, cool. Okay, so we can go back to America and John Cleese will go back to being a professor. Turns out that Jaboa and Donnie have gone back into film. Jaboa is an amazing actress, which was hinted at in her scenes from Shapeshifters Part 8, where like the really like hammy director was like, oh, that was beautiful, darling. You could never do a better take than that. And you're like, is he taking the piss or is he being serious? He was serious. Apparently, she's like the best actor ever. Donnie is a hotshot director who now has a moustache because that's how they've concealed their identity.
They're miserable together.
Yeah, they
he's
hate
always,
each
he's
other.
Always like, darling, you gotta do it again, but put more sex in it. And she's like, I'm not putting sex in it, it's a serious scene. And he's like, don't you tell me our movies always sell out and it's always because they got sex in it. And she's like, no, it's because all the movies are 50% me. That's why I'm the one that should be getting the money. They're miserable together. They should never have left the outback.
I know. It's just that thing of like, oh, that's really what you want, like, near the end of the film, is to find out that the main protagonists, at the end of the day, don't live happily ever after. They fucking hate each other and, like, just live with each other because they have a successful career together.
It's still not over. It's still not over. So, Vekmeyer?
Yeah, yeah.
Whatever
his name. John Cleese.
John Cleese is giving a lecture at a university, and he gets visited by a guy, and now, you know, a guy in his 20s, claiming to be the son of Jaboa and Donnie. He explains, oh, they went into hiding. You know, she went into hiding as the most famous actress on Earth.
Yeah.
And he's like, oh, of course, I've heard of her. Never recognized her as the person he's been searching for 15 years. Whatever. And he's like, well, you'll see her on TV tonight. Cut two, he goes back to his apartment, which looks all futuristic because obviously it's 15 years in the future.
Yeah.
They are watching an awards show, basically the Oscars, which is hosted by an actor that I would like to host my own awards ceremony.
Yeah?
The person that hosts this this Oscar ceremony within the world of the Howling Three Marsupials is the third ever recipient of a Bitter End Endy Award.
Who is it, Todd? Who is it?
Congratulations, Dame Edna.
Yes! Fucking Dame Edna Everidge, played by Barry Humphreys, is in this film because Australia.
Australia! It's amazing! Is it possible that some people listening to this might not know who Dame Edna is? I can't conceive of that.
I mean, again, like Jimmy Nail last episode, it's only going to apply to people of a certain age and maybe from, like, I don't know how global the Dame Edna phenomenon was, but do you want to explain who Dame Edna is?
The shortest way to explain it is do a Google image search for Dame Edna. If that's not good for you, Dame Edna is a man called Barry Humphreys in a dress and big horn-rimmed glasses.
Big purple wig.
Purple wig, pretending to be a very flamboyant old lady from Australia.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah. Used to have, like, chat shows and stuff like that in the 80s and 90s. Barry Humphreys, for a more modern reference, was the Goblin King in the first Hobbit film. The one who looks like he had, like, a chin made out of massive balls.
Oh, man. And fucking Barry Humphreys / Dame Edna has some massive balls to be in this movie. And that is why Dame Edna gets this Endy Award. The Endy Award are award for enthusiasm.
All I'd like to say to all those nominees, it's not playing the game. It's the winning that counts.
Dame Edna throws fucking everything that Dame Edna has at the camera for this. It is so full on.
It's a fisheye lens camera as well, right in her face.
Yeah, she's presenting this award. Long story short, she gives it to Jaboa for her apparently amazing actress career. Everyone in the crowd starts taking flash photography of her. We know from earlier from Rules Corner that flashing lights can turn werewolves to wolf out. She wolfs out. She fucking wolfs right into Dame Edna's neck, at which point Dame Edna is screaming into a fisheye lens, just going, ah! Then we cut to Jack Citrin, the director of the horror movie from like way back at the start of the film, and he just goes, cut. And then the credits roll.
And that's it. Oh my God! It goes from, like, this film having, like, a 20-minute lull at the end, and then it suddenly falls asleep at the wheel, accelerates, and hits a brick wall, and then the credits roll. Oh. That is what it's like. It's insane.
But, mate, that Dame Edna bit, I'm all about it.
Because it says in the credits, and we were, like, the opening credits, and it says, and featuring Barry Humphreys. And we were just like, where is Barry Humphreys? Why is Dame Edna not in it? And then just right at the end, boom, pow, right in the kisser. Good night, nurse.
Oh, I love it.
So
that's the movie, guys.
What do you reckon?
I can't speak for the Bitter End as a corporation at the moment. I can only speak for myself. It's Toddly T, your mate, your pal, your buddy. I am telling you to watch this film. This is a Toddly T recommends.
I mean, because I would recommend that people should watch Howling 2 because it is so dumb. And so by that criteria alone, you should definitely watch this film as well. It's a weird one, man.
I mean, it's according to IMDb, it's a 0.2 worse than part two than the Howling 2. Your sister is a werewolf.
Yeah,
I don't think it's worse.
No, it's very odd because of those scenes that are spoofing horror. Because you kind of think, oh, okay, so maybe this is like, you know, like it seems like certain like horror franchises, they suddenly get a little bit more jokey.
They do seem to, yeah, like joke up.
And you think, okay, so maybe this is the vibe we're going for. This is set in Australia. It's going to be a bit silly. But no, it's actually like only like the little bit when they're filming Shapeshifters. And you know, it came from Uranus that things get a little bit jokey, and then suddenly it gets very serious and like ecological, and like, you know, there's a whole bit which is just like people just living. There's a fucking montage of people planting things for like 5 minutes when they're just living in the outback. It doesn't get jokey, and so like the bits where he's spoofing, the director is spoofing horror, you just think, I don't think you have the right to spoof horror when you've just come off the back of Howling 2.
Yeah.
Like, it's very strange choices and made all the stranger by the fact that this guy has already done one of these films. You know?
I do know.
He's kind of learned his lesson. There's none of those, like, just random, quite so many random shots and, like, awful wipes. Like, it's just that bit at the end when he goes, when you get the director just saying cut towards camera. That harks back to the second one, I feel.
I'm sorry to say, when you say that he learned his lesson, he is not in charge of the next film we're about to watch, Howling for the Original Nightmare.
Yes.
He's no longer at the helm. So this was his last foray, as far as I'm aware, into a Howling movie. Which is maybe a shame, because I feel like he's just starting to find his feet.
I mean, the thing is, both of these films are, you know, academically bad films, but they are both quite a lot of fun to watch because of the car crash nature of them. They are entertaining, if nothing else, just because of how bad they are. What worries me going forward with the franchise is, like, becoming generic.
Yeah, I mean, on this podcast, we've definitely watched films before that were better than this and hated them more.
Yeah.
You know, we've had some dark days, you and me, sitting down to watch 90-minute films that just felt like they dragged on forever.
Yeah, definitely.
And we watch them, so you don't have to, guys. This is a free service that we provide.
Yeah. Final point about this film. It says in the opening credits, based on the book Howling 3, by the author of Howling 1 and 2. I did a little search about this on, like, Wikipedia about the book, and it says in the Wikipedia page, the film Howling 3 bears little to no resemblance to the book Howling 3.
You can't do that. Yeah. You can't say it's based on a book when it's not.
Yeah, it's like basically like shares the title with the same, you know, with another piece of media.
You can't do that.
No.
I've written an erotic horse racing novel. It's called Bleak House. You can't do that. Good God.
Yeah. But I do like that they were just kind of like, that is in there. That's like, they're just like, should we try and sell a few copies of the book? Yeah, we'll try and sell a few copies. But I mean, no one's going to watch this and then go and read the fucking book.
They did not count on me, Tom.
No.
They did not count on me.
Oh, dearie me. But yeah, so what's the next film?
So the next film, on the subject of the book, the next film, it's called Howling 4, The Original Nightmare.
Mm.
And I'm here to tell you that it is based on the same book that the first Howling film is based on.
Ooh.
Apparently, I haven't seen it yet, apparently it's more faithful to the book than the original film was. So it's kind of a remake, or at least a reboot, but they're still calling it The Howling 4. It's the second time that book has been turned into a film.
Because, yeah, I was reading that the author of The Howling,
Gary Brandner,
yeah, that he was not super keen on the first Howling film, and that the only film that he actually helped write was Howling 2.
What?
Dude has got some skewed ideas about, like, story and film and, like, what? That's weird, man.
So I'm really, really keen to see the second attempt at turning his original vision into a movie. I'm fully prepared to meet this movie head on.
Oh, yeah.
I'm gonna meet it on its own terms, and I'm ready to be entertained by it. I would like to see some more... what would I like to see? Some more mystery around the wolves. In the first film, one of the things that I really like is this element of, like, who's the werewolf? Who's the werewolf? Who's the werewolf going to be? The big reveal. Oh, it's everybody.
Yeah, the other two, they're basically like, there's a wolf right there, like, within 5 minutes.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm hoping there's going to be a little bit more mystery here, but I feel like maybe those damn bean counters are going to be, like, pushing the wolves in from square one.
Do the wolves come from Zeist?
Mate, don't even joke.
Let me dream.
All right, guys, so we better wrap it up, but thank you very much for continuing to listen to the Bitter End podcast. I am Todd Jordan.
I'm Tom Denny.
If you've enjoyed this at all, please pop on iTunes, leave us a review. It would make a big difference to us. Until next time, what do Australian people say?
Have a ripping good time, mate.
Bye-bye.
Bonza.